You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
One of the first people NSA leaker Edward Snowden reached was award-winning filmmaker Laura Poitras, and he seems to have chosen wisely. Her film, Citizen Four, is remarkable not only because it takes you into the hotel room in Hong Kong where Snowden, Poitras, and Glenn Greenwald met for the first time, a meeting that would make history. It's also a thorough examination of the reach of the NSA and the potential implications of mass surveillance for a democracy. Citizen Four opens in theaters around the area today, and I'm very pleased that it brings Laura Poitras back to our show. Hello.
Hi, it's great to be here again.
How did Edward Snowden first reach out to you?
Yeah, I received an email in January 2013 from, it's actually, he contacted me through a mutual, actually somebody who I work with and trying to get in touch with me. And the first email was really simple, just trying to make contact and ask if I had an encryption key, which is how you can communicate privately. So I said, you know, here you go. And, you know, what's up? Who are you? And then the next email is when he said, you know, well, I work in the intelligence community and this isn't going to be a waste of your time.
And he says that he didn't choose you. You chose yourself.
Right. So what he was referring to there was the fact that I was put on a government watch list and for several years was detained every time I returned to the U.S. So I'd be questioned and stopped at the border. And I'd written about that a bit. And I'd also been working on the topic of NSA surveillance. I'd been filming with NSA whistleblower William Binney, who is an older generation of people who came forward to try to expose, you know, what the NSA was doing, particularly in terms of domestic surveillance. So I had made a short film that was published by the New York Times, and I think Edward Snowden saw that.
Did you ever confront the government as to why you were stopped every time?
Well,
because
sure.
Because you had, as an American citizen, you had as much right to go through to your plane as anyone else.
Right. I mean, that's one of the sort of pernicious things about this secret watch list is you actually don't know why you're on it, and you don't. There's no way really to find out the reason. So, yeah, I did file a FOIA. The ACLU filed a FOIA on my behalf, and we got some documents back. But basically what the government's position was is that they wouldn't even confirm or deny the existence of a watch list, much less why I was on it. I've actually learned a lot more about the watch list process now. But it's basically, I think, part of the, you know, the expansions of the you know, national security state in the post-9/11 era that they have this watch list system.
Well, to some degree, we all appreciate it. We don't want, when people get through despite the watch list and wind up causing trouble, then we say, why did things go wrong? Why weren't they caught?
Well, I mean, I would argue that, you know, since I was stopped and detained and interrogated for over 6 years, dozens of times, I actually think that, you know, we do live in, you know, a country that has a rule of law, and there should be some way to address this, some sort of due process.
This was harassment, you're saying.
I don't know if it's harassment. I don't think that there are people who sit around and look at films and put people that, you know, on watch lists because of their expression. But I do think that there is a sort of a Kafka-esque system that once you get caught up in it, there's really no way to get out of it. And I think that, you know, there should be a way to challenge why one is put on it and to hopefully get off of it.
Getting back to Snowden, did you think he was legitimate at first? The early messages are quite cryptic. Some people might have said, can I really trust this person?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I had those questions, which I you know, posed to him directly. I said, you know, I said, why are you contacting me? I said, how do I know that you're not trying to entrap me? And how do I know that, you know, that you're not crazy? I think those were the sort of range of things.
Reasonable.
And he said, well, you know, I'm not trying to entrap you because I'm not going to ask anything of you. And you'll know that I'm not crazy because once you get documents and you ask for comment by officials, their response will confirm the validity of the documents.
Often when we're communicating online with people that we've never seen in person, we tend to imagine what they're like. How did you envision Snowden before you actually met him?
Right. I mean, that's a good question. I actually, when we were the first 3 months of our correspondence, you know, I assumed he would always remain anonymous, that he would never come forward and I would never meet this person. At some point I would receive documents and this person would disappear. And I had imagined somebody who was certainly much older and And it's not just that I imagined that. He actually led me to believe it. I think that he wanted to sort of throw me off the trail. He would talk about, I remember back in the Bush years. And he would use those kind of frame, and he would talk about William Binney and Thomas Drake, previous whistleblowers. So I kind of thought that he was more in their generation than as young as he was.
Did you have a solid sense of his political views or his motivations from your online conversations?
Yeah, I did. I mean, he was clearly sort of a constitutionalist and idealist, believed in, you know, the fact that the right to privacy under the Fourth Amendment, and those things all came through in his correspondence and sort of were consistent once I met him.
On the film, you show encrypted messages. Are those the real encrypted messages that you then translate into something we can read?
What you see in the film, the words are from the actual emails. There have been some things that I've protected. Like, so for instance, I had a private key that I used to communicate, and I didn't want to publish that. So there's a sort of, I created another key around the same timeline. So there's some slight changes.
When he first sent you NSA documents, was the enormity and scope of what he was sharing, was that immediately apparent?
It was. You know, the way that it happened, at some point I received an encrypted, the information was encrypted. I didn't have the key to unlock it. And then right before traveling to Hong Kong, I received the key that opened some of the documents. And, yeah, I knew the enormity at that point.
Did it feel like a burden?
Yeah, I mean, it did. I mean, it felt, you know, I'd never seen anything like that. And I don't think, you know, really anyone else has who didn't work in the intelligence community.
How did Glenn Greenwald come into this
story? Right. So my you know, dear friend and colleague Glenn, so Edward Snowden had tried to contact him in December 2012, and they did some back and forth, and the anonymous person, who we now know to be Snowden, tried to get him to use what's called PGP encryption. And it's a bit complicated, and Glenn didn't figure it out, and Snowden wouldn't say too much. He just said, I have some information that I think you'd be interested in. And so Glenn, it sort of, at some point, Snowden gave up. And then I received an email asking for my key, and I had been using encryption at this point, so it was easy for me. And then early in our correspondence, with my correspondence with the source, he said that the information would require more than one person to report, and he recommended that I involve Glenn. So Snowden really always wanted Glenn to work on this.
And he wanted to meet you face to face. He asked you and Glenn to come to Hong Kong to meet him. Was there ever a point where you thought, this is crazy, or why don't we just do it through the internet?
It actually was the opposite. He didn't want to meet face to face. I actually requested the meeting. So in April, as I said before, I thought he'd always remain anonymous. In April, I learned that he actually intended to come forward, to not to remain an anonymous source and claim his responsibility for these disclosures. And then I said, well, if you're going to come forward, then I want to meet you. I want to meet you, and I want to bring my camera, and I want to understand your choices. And then his response was no, he didn't want to be the story. And then I convinced him that why it was important, that of course he would become the story. And that's how we sort of led towards this trip to Hong Kong.
My guest is Laura Poitras, whose film Citizen Four is opening in theaters around town. You went over the documents on the plane with Greenwald.
Glenn, so I had received some and shared them with Glenn. And so what had happened is, so Glenn and I had a meeting in April where I told him I'd been contacted by a source and did he want to be involved in the reporting, and he immediately said yes. And then he went back to Rio, and I couldn't speak to him for a long time because, again, he didn't have encryption. But then finally, right before the end of May, he got back and Snowden got in touch with him. So Glenn made a trip to New York where I was here. And, yeah, Snowden had shared some documents and I had some. And Glenn looked at them while we were traveling.
So you knew that this was legitimate. He had the Guardian, a major newspaper, behind him, but you didn't have any institutional support.
I was actually at that point on one story. I was working as a freelancer with the Washington Post, and so I had Barton Gellman and I had brought the story for the PRISM document to the Washington Post. So I did have a freelance contract with the Post, but you're right, I didn't have a lot of institutional support. And the Post actually decided to pull out sending, and Barton decided not to travel. So I did certainly feel that I was in a more vulnerable position than, you know, Glenn or people who had the full institution behind them.
In Hong Kong, the story takes on a kind of a spy thriller element. Snowden asks you to meet him in the hotel lobby to look for men playing with a Rubik's Cube. Now, I don't think I've ever seen someone playing with a Rubik's Cube in public, at least over the age of 14. Didn't that make him look a little conspicuous?
These were the plans, and it was.
It worked.
It did work. You know, there wasn't anybody else who had a Rubik's Cube inside the Mira Hotel lobby that morning, so it was easy to spot him. Glenn and I definitely were taken aback by how young he was, but we quickly, you know, readjusted.
And then you started filming immediately after you got into the hotel room. You didn't even wait to feel things out.
Yeah, I know. Glenn writes about that. But, you know, the thing is that I've known Glenn for a while, and he doesn't really waste a lot of time. So I knew Glenn was going to sort of, you know, hit the ground running. So I wanted to be ready and not sort of be polite. And by that point, you know, everybody knew that I was going to be documenting this. I mean, I had had the consent of Snowden, and Glenn knew that I was going to do that. And it was a pretty, I felt, you know, my role in Hong Kong, that this was an extraordinary sort of journalistic encounter, and I wanted to film it, and I didn't want to miss sort of the beginning of it.
And Snowden seems to be a natural in front of the camera. He doesn't seem to maintain he does seem to maintain a lot of poise throughout the film, even though he's under a lot of pressure.
Yeah, I mean, it was extraordinary. I think Glenn and I and Ewan McCaskill, who The Guardian also sent, were all sort of disoriented and trying to kind of get our bearings. And Snowden was just incredibly calm and articulate. And I think it's partly his nature, but I also think, you know, here was a person who had kind of crossed the point of no return. Like, he had decided to take, you know, major risks in his life, and that he felt his job in that moment was to talk to the journalists so that we could understand what he knew, why he felt it was dangerous, and you know, give us whatever information we needed to report.
And he also was putting a lot of trust in the two of you. He didn't even tell his girlfriend where he was.
Well, right, of course. I mean, he told no one.
So that hotel room must have felt incredibly claustrophobic.
It was, I mean, I was very tense. I, you know, imagined that, I mean, someone could knock on the door at any moment. It did feel, you know, certainly the risks were highest for him, but I felt also for the journalists working that there were also risks.
Although we feel your presence in the film in the sense that you're behind the camera and you narrate parts of the film, we don't see you. Is this because you are subscribing to the Maisel's approach, fly on the wall approach to filmmaking?
I come out of the sort of verite filmmaking where you film things happening before your eyes in real time. I mean, I'm actually operating the camera, and for me, the way I express myself as a filmmaker, as a journalist, and as an artist is through the camera lens. I mean, that's my tool for articulating what it is that I want to say. So it's very hard. I mean, I was there alone. I was doing camera and sound, and so it's not that I was hiding from the camera. I was operating the camera.
Did Snowden's demeanor change once he told the world who he was and gave his reasons for releasing all of those films? Did you get the sense that he was a bit afraid but also a bit attracted by the celebrity?
I never felt he was attracted by the celebrity. I think this was something that he, you know, he made the decisions because he felt that this was the right thing to do and that he knew there would be consequences, and he didn't ever want to be the story. However, he did get pulled in. There is a way in which you see in the hotel room, you know, he says at the beginning, I've never talked to anyone in the media. And you see that there is a kind of, you know, it's a really feels like a first encounter. And I've seen him, you know, do Skype. Okay. And so I've seen him do more, you know, public interviews. And, you know, things have changed.
Well, were you worried at any point the police might bust into the room? There was one of my favorite moments in the film is when a fire alarm keeps ringing in the hotel room where you were filming. You must have thought something strange was happening. The authorities were on to you.
Sure. I mean, you know, anything that sort of made noise or, you know, we imagined, you know, the worst, there's a knock at the door at one point, everyone jumps. So there was a lot of tension.
And as the movie progressed, I got the feeling that there was anxiety creeping over all of you. Is that the case?
For sure. I mean, I think we knew that, you know, this reporting was going to anger the most powerful people in the world. So we were nervous.
And I'm sure many people ask you whether you were feeling a bit paranoid at the time.
No, I mean, I think that that's actually wrong. I think seeing what the government is doing in terms of targeting journalists, you know, subpoenaing the AP's records, I mean, those kinds of things just mean I think we have to take precautions to protect sources.
As you mentioned earlier, you've made a number of films which examine national security and foreign policy, including The Oath, the Oscar-nominated My Country, My Country. What led you to make U.S. policies and overreach after 9/11 your major subject?
I felt the first film I made, which was about the Iraq War, that there was sort of a moral drift in this country, you know, away from fundamental principles, and that it was important to say something about that and to document it.
Well, hadn't you been a chef before you got into filmmaking?
That's right, yeah.
They usually, the connection usually leads people to make films about things like GMOs.
Well, yeah, I mean, I learned in cooking. I mean, I really loved doing it, but there was a limit to, you know, what you could do, sort of what you could express with cooking.
My guest is Laura Poitras. Her new film is called Citizen 4. It's controversial. We'll get into some of the controversies in the second part of our conversation. The film is opening in theaters around town and got a pretty great review in today's New York Times. Stay with us for more. And we are back with Laura Poitras, whose film Citizen 4 is opening in theaters around town today. You live in Berlin now, a city that was arguably one of the most surveilled places in the world during the Cold War, especially by the Stasi in East Berlin. How does that legacy of spying on ordinary people inform the culture there?
There's actually a lot of awareness of the dangers of surveillance from the Stasi era, and it's now become. I mean, the country. The reason I actually went there is because the laws are actually so good now on privacy. So that's why I relocated there to edit.
Glenn Greenwald said that he won't testify before a Bundestag inquiry into the NSA unless the German government offers Snowden asylum. Do you think that's likely?
I think that there's a lot of popular support for Edward Snowden. I think citizens actually are very appreciative to the information he's revealed. I think that, you know, the political situation between, you know, Germany not wanting to upset the U.S. government, I think that makes it a complicated thing. But I think what actually Glenn's position is that he thinks that Snowden should be allowed to testify and brought into the country to testify.
Well, the whole situation of surveillance got muddied up when it was revealed that Angela Merkel had been subject to surveillance. But then it turns out most world leaders have.
Right. I mean, it's probably not a surprise that world leaders are – that governments surveil other world leaders. We did actually have her phone number. It's a story that I worked on with Der Spiegel and my colleagues there. And on one hand, it obviously created a lot of, you know, press coverage, which I have a bit ambivalent about, because so much of the reporting we've done has shown, you know, the sort of dragnet, suspicionless surveillance, which I think is much more disturbing than, you know, than leaders of countries.
Do you think that the vast surveillance machine that we've constructed in this country since 9/11 will ever be switched off?
You know, again, I'd go back to, you know, I live in what used to be the former East Germany. And so, yeah, you have to believe that, you know, history can change. I do think that it's a vast system that sort of becomes self-perpetuating through, you know, in the post 9/11 era, and there are contractors and there's a whole system that relies on this. But you have to hope that, you know, the policy can change.
Well, some people are suggesting that you drop out. And that's one way to protect your privacy. Apple recently said it was increasing encryption abilities for users. Should we all get better at hiding what we do online?
Actually, absolutely. I mean, I've been saying this, you know, as I talk to people about the film, is that we don't need to wait for the government to change policy, because there are encryption technologies that everyone can use, and they're created by a free software community of people. And everyone can download these tools. I mean, we're going to put a link on our website for the film where people can find out what tools to use.
What do you think of the reaction of some people who confronted with the fact that the NSA has been collecting data, probably theirs as well as everyone else, simply saying, well, I've got nothing to hide?
I mean, I think that that attitude, if you ask those same people, well, then would you mind if we turn the camera on your laptop in your home, or if we put cameras in your house, or if we get your passwords for your email? I mean, in all cases, people would say no. I actually don't think privacy is a matter of taste. I think it actually is a fundamental human, both a right and a need.
When Glenn Greenwald was on our show recently, he described the NSA as both menacing and inept. You agree?
I would agree with Glenn on that one. Yeah, I mean its capabilities are vast beyond imagination, and then you also get the sense that they're collecting so much data that they're swimming in data.
And we don't wind up stopping the Boston Marathon bomber, for example.
Right, and we find out after the fact that there are all the tips that that could have led to it. Another example is the underwear bomber, where the father of the man who flew in actually went to the U.S. Embassy and said, "My son is dangerous," and we didn't revoke his visa.
And then there was the bomb in Midtown, New York, that was actually revealed by people who were street vendors, not because anybody was watching that person.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think this idea that we need to surveil everyone creates so much information that it's hard to know where the real leads are.
Fred Kaplan wrote a review of Citizen Foreign Slate in which he called you a very talented filmmaker who flipped from journalist to collaborator in the story. And he said that you've chosen to leave out what he feels is a major problem, that some of the documents Snowden downloaded and turned over to you and Glenn Greenwald go far beyond exposures of spying on Americans.
I mean, I think, first of all, for a journalist to call other journalists collaborators is very dangerous. I mean, that's actually the language that was used to get Jim Rosen of Fox News get his information in relation to another leak investigation. I think that, this is, moving towards criminalizing journalism, and I think that's actually very dangerous. But in terms of his other argument, every story that has been published has gone through extensive, journalistic reporting and editorial process, and decisions were made that the information was newsworthy.
Some journalists have turned on you and Glenn Greenwald. Does this suggest that there's a split in the journalistic world as to what is appropriate and what isn't appropriate?
I mean, I'm curious which journalist you're referring to. I mean, there's obviously David Gregory, there's sort of a notorious interview that he did with Glenn. But,
and then, of course, he lost his job.
Yeah. I think that the way that the story unfolded was not the way that the mainstream media wanted. And because Glenn and I, come at it from a bit more of an outsider perspective, things were a bit more unpredictable. And I think that people who are, working in more in the mainstream media were somewhat threatened by the fact that the story came to us and not to them. So I think there's a bit of tension there. But I also think, I've felt personally that there's been an enormous amount of support for our reporting. Like, I think unlike in the UK, where I feel that the Guardian was really isolated and the press didn't step up for the reporting that they were doing, I think in the US there's been, I think everyone has recognized the value of this reporting, even if the story didn't go to them.
Now, since people know that the NSA is collecting this information, do you think that will lead some to self-censor?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that's the real danger. That's the sort of chilling effect. I mean, William Binney, who, says at the end of the film that this is a real threat to democracies, and that he had spent his career, fighting against the Soviet Union and how the sort of a system works when people are surveilled by their own governments. I mean, it creates a chilling effect. You start to censor. I mean, I certainly feel that in my work. I'm obviously a different case because I should, given the reporting I'm doing, maybe it's more likely that I'm surveilled than others are. But I do think that, if you're an activist, if you're a journalist, that you should be careful.
Has the NSA ever contacted you directly?
No, but the NSA doesn't contact people directly. I mean, they're an intelligence service. I mean, I think if I was contacted directly, it would be somebody from another agency. But I've had no contact since I began this reporting.
And living in Berlin makes your job a little easier?
I think living in Berlin does. I would have been concerned editing this film that I would get a knock on the door and perhaps there would be an effort to subpoena my footage. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The German government so far has not given you a hard time.
No, the German government hasn't given me a hard time. I have heard from different sources that, you know, intelligence sources, that I'm lit up like a Christmas tree, but no one's knocking on my
door. Up like a Christmas tree, that means you assume that your apartment is bugged?
Do you think that could make
you a little paranoid?
No, it's not about my apartment being bugged. I think it's just, you know, who I'm emailing, who, you know, it's more, I think, of electronic communication.
You had to include yourself in this, even though you were reluctant to do it, because you were the only person who made any sense in reading the initial communications from Snowden.
It wasn't just that I was the only person. I mean, it was obvious once I became a participant in this narrative. So I was the person that Snowden had contacted, and we had this correspondence for 5 months, and I traveled. I mean, everything, all the events happened because of my involvement. So I was obviously a participant, so it had to be told from a subjective point of view. But I think that there's a long tradition of non-fiction writing and journalism that is told from a subjective point of view and is still, you know, clearly journalism. So clearly that was an obvious choice for me.
And in this case, you intersperse fly-on-the-wall conversations with Snowden, with public record, things from the public record, testimony before Congress and things of that sort, or talking heads, some of the people who also have been part of this story. But the suggestion is that we are being lied to at times by the people who are running these programs. That's a bit scary, isn't it?
Right. I mean, sure, I think the most notorious example is James Clapper's comments when Ron Wyden was questioning him about whether or not, you know, the NSA is surveilling Americans, and he clearly lied, and Wyden actually knew the information, which was the secret interpretation of the Patriot Act, which allowed for the bulk record collection that Glenn exposed in the Verizon story.
You did go to Russia. Mm-hmm. Where Edward Snowden's been living for a while now. Why didn't you follow him there?
So I've made a few trips and have filmed with him. He went underground in Hong Kong, and I waited a little bit and to see if there was any way I could continue filming, but it just felt like it wasn't possible, and I detected that I was being watched. So then I left and went back to Berlin, and at some point... So what had happened is that WikiLeaks came in, and one of their journalists, Sarah Harrison, assisted him to seek political asylum. And as they were transiting through Moscow, his passport was revoked. So they were sort of caught in this limbo in the airport in Moscow. And I actually did try to—I was in touch with him over encryption, and I said, can I come? I'd like to film. And it didn't work. So unfortunately, I wasn't able to film during that time. But I did go to Moscow after.
Many people have pointed out that going to Russia to protect yourself against the sort of thing that the NSA does is slightly ironic.
Well, I mean, he didn't actually intend to go there. I mean, he was transiting through, and his passport was revoked. And you know, then he was able to – well, he applied for political asylum in many countries. And in some cases, you need to be in the country to apply. In other cases, people turned down. So he did receive it in Russia. But I know that it wasn't his intention to be there.
Citizen 4 opens today at Lincoln Plaza Cinemas and the IFC Center. And it has been my great pleasure to talk with the woman who made this film, Laura Poitras. Fascinating. Thank you so much.